In 2001, field recordist Aaron Zim, a.k.a. Quiet American, took a trek through Nepal, gathering sounds, Buddhist ceremonies, prayer wheels, and this passing donkey train. I'm Barrett Golding. This is Hearing Voices from NPR. We're in the mountains this next hour. Skiing, trekking, and tracking lost mountain folk. Warren, Idaho is in the north central part of the state, part of the Payette National Forest. Has a population of about a dozen people, and it has a secret. Here's NPR's Alex Chadwick.
Jeff Fee's hunting camp. A place beside a stream on a high meadow in the mountains of Idaho's Payette National Forest. A big horse was suddenly frantic, trying to pull up a small tree where it was tied. It was one of Fee's horses. He'd tethered it to a sapling because he was going off on a stablemate, and if he didn't fasten the Appaloosa somewhere, it would try to follow.
Hey! 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 Jeff!
But it looked as though the horse meant to follow anyway. It yanked and strained back until it nearly sat on its haunches. It bent the pine in a bow. Where the rope pulled tight around the trunk, it tore away bark from the pale wood underneath. Fee's wife waited for the animal to pause in its lunges. She moved cautiously to where she could reach to touch its wild head. Some of the wildness drained away. Then her husband was riding fast back down the dirt road that ran nearby, and with the other horse in sight again. The moment passed.
How do you do that?
Jeff Fee is 43 years old. He has children and grandchildren. An ancestor was a Shawnee Indian. He is big and healthy looking, and more than healthy looking, actually healthy too. He said he sometimes presses 350 pounds from a weight bench, and I believe he can do it. Fee works for the U.S. Forest Service, and he spends most of his life outdoors. He is often on a horse, back in places without roads. He is a very accomplished woodsman, leading a very satisfactory life, made more so because he is also a student of history. And near this place, he has found some.
When I'm out in the hills working, sometimes I'll come across people who will introduce themselves and ask me what I do. And I explain to them that I'm an archaeologist that works for the Forest Service. They cannot understand that. What does the forest have to do with archaeology?
What indeed would an archaeologist do in the woods? Fee's hunting camp is not very far from Warren, Idaho, a town named for a prospector who found gold there back during the Civil War. Going to Warren now, traffic stops because sheep graze across the dirt road. They're safe enough doing so. There are many more sheep than cars here. You drive up for a ways, and the land plateaus, and then there's another stretch of up road and a pass, and then an airstrip worn in the grass beside the road. And then you come to Warren, a little more than a mile high. A long time ago, practically every place must have looked like this, and now almost no place does. The log and plank buildings are weathered dark. Some of them settle and sag out of line. Most are abandoned, but closed up as though someone means to return someday. The tin roofs rust. A sign identifies the Warren Dance Hall, but it's many years since anyone danced here regularly. Still, people live in Warren and like living there.
And it's pretty yellow gold once you get it treated. You never saw anything prettier.
An old man, a gold miner, shares a small two-room cabin with his wife. Out back by a stream, he's got some machinery he can use to crush ore. breaking it down to get at the wealth inside. The equipment looks like cement mixers in a construction yard. In total, 11 people live in the old town all the time, right through the winter even, although the roads close then, and there's no way out but plane or snowmobile, or a walk that many people would not survive. The old man first saw Warren when he was a boy, back in the early 20s.
I was born to Tamarack, and that's the other side of New Meadows a little ways. And I came with a team and a buggy and my dad. And there was no such a thing as a road like there is now. It was a cow trail. Boy, I'm telling you, you went in and out of gullies and across ditches and across water, across the river down there, and swim the horses nearly to get across.
His cabin is overrun with hoarded goods, with things kept past any use an outsider could see. The glass in a window is browned with smoke from the wood stove. There's a strained quality to the light. He's almost 80 and thin. He must have been 6'2 or 3 once. He's a little hunched over now. His hands are still strong.
This is no place to farm. This is only a place to mine, and it's a dang cold place to mine, too. This little town right here is nothing in the world but a little mining town. And it was a big one. At one time, it was supposed to be the capital in the state of Idaho and had 6,000 people here. Yes.
Here is something I hadn't known. In the boom days of Warren and the other western mining towns a century ago, a great many of the miners were Chinese. There were opium dens in Warren and Chinese saloons and gambling houses. Once a brothel owner named Hong King kept a slave girl he'd bought, China Polly, until a gambler, Charlie Bemis, won her freedom in a card game. And later on, she saved the gambler's life when he lost a gunfight, and the two of them fell in love and married and grew old together on a ranch down by the Salmon River. That's the kind of story they can tell in Warren, although there's nothing to see now that shows the Chinese were there.
We're back in those days when you were working here. You must have been a pretty young man then.
I was.
How many Chinese were there left in Warren?
Oh, I would guess there'd be 30.
30?
Yeah, there was about 30 left here. And at one time, I guess, there was close to 2,500. There were many a Chinaman here made a lot of money. And when they went to go back to China, they were rich Chinamen. You know, they had lots of gold. And they would make gold out of a piece of ground that a white man wouldn't even spit on. You know, they'd get gold out of stuff that the white man would, well, lose his shirt on. That's the way to put it.
Did you admire them?
Well, you betcha. I admire them. They had the guts enough to stay with it, and they had guts enough to make it. And a lot of white people don't have that kind of guts. I have halfway got that, but not all of it. And a lot of times I wished I was somewhere else.
Most of the Chinese who came to Warren and who went elsewhere in the West weren't slaves or indentured railroad workers. They came just as the Europeans had, across an ocean for a chance at wealth and advancement. Many found what they were after, but found, too, that the Europeans did not welcome Asians to the land they had so recently stolen from the Indians. Most of the Chinese went back to China. Even those who died in America had usually arranged to have their remains sent back. By the mid-30s, the Chinese were all gone from Warren, and gradually people forgot some of the details of where they had lived and how they had lived and what they'd done. And then one day, in the forest near Warren, a man made a remarkable discovery.
It first started with a ditch, like a mining ditch that tapped the water out of China Creek. And I followed that ditch out, and I came across cut stumps. And by that I mean somebody years back had fallen trees from there.
Jeff Fee worked for the U.S. Forest Service, which manages the Payette National Forest. His job was to explore parts of the forest that were going to be leased to timber companies for logging, in case there was something in the woods that should be saved. Fee's father had been with the Forest Service, too, and when Jeff was a boy, he had lived in Warren, and heard porch talk about the Chinese who were once there, and stories he could not understand about Chinese gardens. He didn't think a garden could hold on a mountainside. He'd been all through the forest and never seen one. But surveying a canyon above the South Fork of the Salmon River one day, Fee stopped. And as patterns do rearrange themselves to make something new, the land now changed. It began with finding the ditch and the old stumps.
What that says is somebody has worked in here. Somebody's doing something. It's evidence that miners were possibly here. That was my thinking at the time. So I was thinking more in terms of finding probably a miner's cabin or something like that. But as I followed the ditch down, all of a sudden in the middle of nowhere, on a slope that's nearly 25 degree slope, here comes, you can't, it's just obvious. There's terraces there. There's these flat spots.
Fee had stumbled upon the old Chinese gardens terraced into the sides of canyons miles away from Warren. The town is too high for farms and gardens, the growing season too short. But the Chinese miners had remembered techniques from their homeland, and they had descended thousands of feet on canyon sides to where it was warmer. They hoed and filled and dug and planted, and what they did endures today on acres and acres of remote sites near Warren. The Forest Service spent a couple of years studying the gardens, and it's marked them now for preservation. There will be no logging here. Another archaeologist, Larry Kingsbury, pointed the way down the rebuilt trail that leads to the partly restored garden of Atoy, or Charlie Toy, as he was sometimes called.
Here's the China Trail. And from here, we'll descend about 1,200 feet in a mile and a half.
It was Atoy who dug the ditch that Jeff Fee followed to make his discovery. The ditch is there today, a narrow gouge across the face of the canyon. What's called the China Trail runs 50 or 60 feet above the ditch, a narrow path about a foot across in some places, steep and sometimes dangerous, falling away through ponderosa pine and Douglas fir to a place where it was low enough for Charlie Toy to plant a garden on the long parallel shelves of earth that he built. Toy and others supplied Warren with fresh produce from the spring right through the fall, years before there was a road anyone could take to outside markets.
This is China Creek. China Creek is the sole water source that irrigated all of the Chinese gardens on this mountain slope.
Here in an isolated canyon, far away in Idaho, lies Jeff Fee's remarkable rediscovery, the largest Chinese terraced gardens known to exist outside Asia.
You've spent a lot of time in the forest around here, as a boy and as a man. Do you feel anything different or special when you go there? Can you sense any meaning to that ground?
When I go into the terraced gardens?
Yeah.
Oh, it seems like I know Charlie Toy. It seems like I've met him before and I've talked to him, although all I've seen is the evidence, the archaeological evidence that he's left, and the terraces that he's carved out, although I don't think he's carved all of them. He's carved a good share of them. Everything he did down there was on a slope. He had to be extremely strong. He had to have good endurance, both mentally and physically. And I can't help but have a tremendous amount of respect for him, even though I've never met him.
When the work was finished, late in the day, the Chinaman sat in the shadows on the small terrace in front of his stone-walled dugout. The sun lay down long rays on the narrow, humped ridge that started straight away on the opposite side of the canyon, and then changed its mind and swung north to follow the course of the South Fork of the Salmon River. A big peak loomed in back, the shapes steep and forced together. From the terrace, Atoy couldn't actually see the river, but he heard it on the valley floor 1,000 feet below. He was fiddling with the opium, cooking it down to black tar, and then spreading the paste in the bowl of his pipe. When he was done, he held it close to the flame and pulled the smoke in, and then he rested. In his dreams, he imagined going back to China. It would be important to go back, to be able to show what he had done. Atoy would be a rich man there, rich from the gold he'd dug, and because the ways of gardening that everyone used in China were uncommon in the new land, and there was a kind of opportunity in the ignorance of others. He would be a rich man in China, but he would come back to America anyway. He had to, really. Atoy had discovered that he no longer was Chinese. He was becoming something new. So he'd come back to Idaho, probably, although maybe not to the gardens, the long days digging and planting and climbing the steep, difficult land. Perhaps he would think of something else. Atoy lay in reverie and dreamed of life in an American town. Many years later, when Atoy had visited China and returned, he finally settled in McCall, close to the real mountain country in Idaho, but not actually in it. He bought a hotel and hired a Chinese cook, and he grew too old and fat to ever again follow the old China Trail from where it begins near Warren to where the land falls down to the South Fork of the Salmon River. When he died, more years later, a doctor who examined the body said only that it appeared Atoy's heart had burst. Atoy is buried somewhere in McCall. The terraced gardens he and others left behind remain isolated in the far country of the Payette National Forest.
Alex Chadwick for NPR's Radio Expeditions. Sound designed by Michael Schweppe, produced by Carolyn Jensen Chadwick. The Atoy Gardens are now on the National Register of Historic Places. You are hearing voices in the mountains. This is a large prayer wheel recorded in Nepal by the Quiet American.
Yes, I'm climbing high mountain, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. Yes, I'm climbing high mountain, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. Lord, my home in the sky, Lord, I make it alone. by and by. Yes, I'm climbing higher mountain, trying to make it home. I've been drinking tears for water, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. Lord, I'm drinking tears for water, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. Lord, my home in the sky, Lord, I'll make it there, Lord, by and by. Yes, I'm climbing higher mountain, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. I've been giving up there, right for the wrong, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. I've been giving up things, right for the wrong, Lord, trying to make it home, trying to make it home. Lord, my home lies in the sky, Lord, I make it there, Lord, by and by. Yes, I'm climbing higher mountain, trying to make it home.
That's Robert Nighthawk Johnson. Coming up, Scott Carrier goes skiing in the Wasatch Range of Utah, and Joe Frank attempts an ascent on K2, the second tallest peak on the planet. That's when we continue in the mountains in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Horn Players at Dusk in the Nepalese mountain village of Marfa, recorded by the Quiet American. You are hearing voices in the mountains from Utah Here's producer Scott Carrier.
Sometimes I have nothing better to do than sit on my porch in Salt Lake City and watch how the mountains change shape with the light. The map fixes them at 11,000 feet above sea level, 15 miles away on a straight line, but I've seen them grow taller and shorter, creep up on the city after a snowstorm, and slink away in the summer's heat. I watch the mountains and wonder how long it would take me to get up there, and which way I would come down, and what it would be like. It all depends on the time of year, the time of day, and the weather. If it's May and 2 p.m., and my neighbor is mowing his grass in his shorts, and if in the evening the sky is clear and I wear a coat and hat to sit on my porch and drink beer, and if at night, looking down on the city, the lights twinkle and move in a mirage, then I know I have to set my alarm for 5 a.m. to get up early and go spring skiing. It takes an hour and a half to make coffee, eat some oatmeal, and drive up the canyon to the base of the mountain called Superior. Its southeast face is a white wave, 3,000 feet tall, a slope that gets progressively steeper and then curls over at the top in a cornice. At 6:30, the sun is hitting the top of the peak, and the snow up there is red and warm, while everything under the shadow is blue and cold. In winter, the snow in the Wasatch is light and dry powder, the best in the world. But in spring, the big flakes melt into small ice balls, and the snowpack becomes a consolidated sheet, 5 to 10 feet thick. This sheet freezes hard at night, and then in the day, the surface melts to the consistency of a Slurpee. So the trick in spring skiing is to get up high and be ready to ski down just as the surface is starting to melt. An inch or so of soft snow on top of a hard base is really fun, easy to hold your edge and very fast. But there's a narrow window of time here. If you start down too early, you're skiing on ice. If you go too late, it's like skiing in mush and kind of dangerous because it sometimes slides down the mountain in an avalanche. I reach the ridge about 500 vertical feet from the top, and there are fresh coyote tracks following the crest line of snow toward the summit. I follow the tracks to the top and see that when he got there, he didn't even break stride, just kept going down the north ridge. No time for epiphanies. It's 9:30, and I look down on the valley and see a brown layer of smog over the city from morning rush hour traffic. I look for my house, my neighborhood, but it's under the smudge. I take my skis off my backpack and put them on my feet. I'd rather have wings, but skis will do. I take the top part carefully, like a raven checking out a picnic, then drop through a chute like a dive-bombing falcon, then traverse across the slope at high speed, like an albatross skimming over the ocean. The snow is soft and smooth and fast, just what I thought it would be. My timing is immaculate. I'm at my truck by 9:55, and back home on my porch drinking coffee by 10:45. Time to go to work. That is, if I had a job, other than looking up at the mountains and watching how they change shape with the light.
Producer Scott Carrier for Hearing Voices. We are in the mountains this hour. When it's Buddha's birthday in Nepal, it sounds like this.
Thank you.
You are hearing voices in the mountains. K2 is a mountain on the Pakistan-China border. Producer Joe Frank doesn't know much about mountain climbing, except that he intends to ascend K2, the second tallest peak on the planet.
Northernmost border of Kashmir. Although it is the second highest mountain in the world, it is nevertheless the most difficult to climb because the last mile and a half consists of sheer vertical rock with sub-zero winds that are ferocious. It's a mountain that has had such a history of disasters that nobody tries to climb it anymore, and this is why I decided to attempt it. Now, the conventional approach would be to hire seasoned professional climbers sponsored by a sporting club or adventure magazine or National Geographic, the purpose being to conquer the unassailable for the sheer giddy triumph of achieving the act and take photographs and plant a flag, install a plaque. But I decided I'd be going with my friend Aaron, who's a CPA, and with an eclectic group of people consisting of a proctologist, an existential philosopher, an expert in Near Eastern affairs, a purchasing agent from a small Midwestern manufacturing concern, the principal bassoonist of the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra, and a Second Circuit judge from the state of New York, among others. No one had any mountain climbing experience, and this was very important. Now, in a conventional ascent, you're supposed to bring ropes and pulleys and crampons and hammers and mallets and cleats and tents and oxygen masks and highly sophisticated radio equipment, including GPS, which is a global positioning system which permits climbers the use of stationary satellites to coordinate their exact position by latitude and longitude, and you map out the ascent to the last detail and determine the kinds of food and medicines you'll need, and everyone is trained in first aid and in CPR, in on-site trauma treatment in case of accident, in setting of broken bones, in the application of tourniquets and compresses, even in minor surgery like stitching an open wound, cauterizing a pulsing artery. And before the ascent, you all exercise vigorously to get in shape and take a regimen of powerful vitamins, amino acids, neurotransmitters, endorphins. But we decided that this kind of behavior was beneath us. We were going to ascend the mountain in our own unique fashion. First of all, we decided not to consult any maps of K2. After all, the last thing you want in life is a map, because you see only what someone has seen before you. People are forced to use all kinds of maps to make their way in life. We're all hemmed in by maps. Too often our lives are mapped out for us. Codes, rules, regulations, precedents, preconceived notions of right and wrong pile up until, by the time you're an adult, you're just drowning in the formulas of other people's lives. So, no maps for us. We also decided to be utterly out of condition, to take up smoking, to eat a high-fat, low-carbohydrate, no-fiber diet, and to drink a lot of whiskey, single malt scotches, gin, vodka, bourbon, and sweet liqueurs. And as far as being outfitted for the climb, none of those fancy thermal outfits and goggles for us. No, we'd climb the mountain in shorts, bathroom thongs, and open-necked sports shirts. we were going to ascend K2 in a way it had never before been conquered. The style, the manner, the look, the execution, the quality of the experience would be so dramatically different as to be almost not like climbing a mountain at all, but would be an act of literary, poetic, and sociopathic trailblazing. It would make for us an anti-place in the non-history of the so-called sport of mountain climbing. And the equipment we decided to bring with us consisted of a microwave oven, a hairdryer, a pottery kick wheel, a dishwasher, some floor lamps, a bubble jet color laser printer, hair tonic, fly casting equipment, a barbecue grill with a chef's hat, mallard duck decoys. So that was all the equipment we were going to take up the side of the mountain with us, with the exception of one more item, a huge crucifix, because I thought it would be a good shape to introduce at high altitudes. I was just pleased with the concept of dragging an enormous cross up K2. It was appealing, it had a certain resonance for me, and I thought it should be extremely heavy, made of teak, and studded with nails. And we decided that everyone had to wear a Mardi Gras mask, because it's fun to wear masks when you're taking a long trip. It serves to pass the time, and we also hired a marching band to accompany us with drum majorettes, a parade marshal. The advantage of having a marching band when you're going up a steep climb is that it gives you a beat to which you can set your pace. It buoys your spirit. There's nothing like marching band music to maintain the morale of the group. It energizes you, and the drum majorettes add a certain flair and excitement, wearing their short, pleated skirts, their polyvinyl chloride white 1960s style boots, their tank tops and visored caps. Now, the initial problem you confront with K2 is simply getting there. First, you have to cross a huge salt lake by the Afghani highlands near the city of Balkh. And we made the voyage in an old World War I vintage African Queen riverboat with no engine, entirely wind-powered. And in order to make the trip even more challenging, halfway across the lake, we agreed to get dead drunk, take LSD, and then pour kerosene all over the decks and set fire to the boat to see what would happen. We wanted to set up challenges, challenges that people in other situations might find insurmountable. We were going to create them in order to intensify the metaphor of our journey. And so we had a prodigiously psychedelic experience, which was transcendental, intense, brilliant, insightful, profound. A passage beyond death where deceased family members, departed statesmen, deities, talking fish, animated weather fronts would carry on lively conversations with us and with each other. And the lake turned into the great boiling open mouth of a huge soprano. And later, when we woke up, we were cast on the opposite shore, our clothes shredded, our bodies battered, bruised, some of us impaled on tree branches, others with voracious fish clamped onto their arms and legs. One man was f***ing with an octopus. And those who didn't make it were forever enshrined in the memories and internal histories of those who carried on the standard of the expedition. And the LSD had an interesting effect on us. What happened is that the boundaries between individuals became porous, and personalities were now flowing across borders, so that the individuation of each member of the expedition was becoming less well-defined. We were all flowing into one entity, a single being that consisted not of individual members of an ascent team, but of one great, uniformly unicellular being, one organism. Without an ego, you felt you were part of the larger scheme of things, and you experienced an exhilarating sense of oneness with the universe. Without ego, there is no angst, no jealousy, no self-hatred, no self-doubt, longing, no regret, no sense of loss, no wish to gain, no greed, no striving, no ambition. We have everything that the Buddha rejected. But then there was this nagging doubt about who you were, and this sense that you were suffering from amnesia. And so you desperately wanted to find your way back to yourself, to your storehouse of memories, to the compass that pointed towards your individuality, the set of coordinates unique to yourself, the crossing of the longitude and latitude lines that defined who you were, that place on the map called home, that had your name on it, that was the most familiar place in the world. So sitting around that fire, moving back and forth from oneness with the universe to our own personal lives, was a very strange and unique experience. Because your sense of yourself and your place in the universe kept shifting with the ever-changing tides of consciousness that was the hallmark of the experience. But finally, the LSD wore off. And then we began the second leg of our journey. A 150-mile stretch of road made of red clay, which, when baked in the sun, produced a choking cloud of airborne dust stirred by hot winds. The roadside was alive with scorpions and venomous desert snakes. And there was an occasional orange stand that sold watermelons, tangerine slices, cold beer, and cigarettes. And once, we passed a pair of elderly men engaged in a silent, slow-motion chess game. An hourglass on the table before them. And at their feet, there was a birdcage containing a dwarf who was gripping the bars in his fingers, sullenly staring at us, and urinating into a small pan at the bottom of the cage, which was filled with shredded paper. After this, we had to forge a huge whitewater river. So we strung a rope across and tied it to two trees on opposite sides of the river, and we individually tried to make it across. And the river, being in a valley, was whipped white with powerful gusts of wind that descended off the sides of the mountains. The water raced by as though drawn by some irresistible force. And in the turbulent, raging river below, we saw overturned boats, the remnants of bridges that had been swept away, huge advertising billboards, satellite dishes, and what appeared to be the smokestack of an ocean liner. And some of our members were blown from the bridge into the water and dashed against the rocks that formed the course through which the river ran. And so we lost a few drum majorettes, and the tuba player was swept away screaming, grasping ineffectually at the moss-slick boulders. So we barely got to the other side and held a small service for those who didn't make it. We lit incense, roasted a chicken, had the marching band play Nearer My God to Thee and Amazing Grace. And we carved the names of the deceased into the wooden sides of a miniature cathedral we'd built, and then we set the cathedral afire so that the smoke would reach the heavenly precincts and remain forever part of the Earth's atmosphere. And then we moved on to what appeared to be an impenetrable jungle, alive with carnivorous plants which at night would send poisonous shoots and tendrils down to strangle you and insert sucker buds through your skin and into your muscles and begin to drain the blood and fluid from your body. And we were there on purpose during the monsoon season because we were trying to make the trek as difficult and memorable and challenging as possible. And so we were deluged for 45 days with continual rain. And nothing could be kept dry, so food would rot, and there were digestive disorders and lots of diarrhea, and people were suffering from dehydration. And we celebrated this because it was the most awful, the most horrendous, the most punishing experience of our lives. And by virtue of that, we felt triumphant. We next had to pass through a decayed third world urban landscape with burnt out buildings and smoldering wrecks of automobiles and bands of drunken teenage boys driving armored personnel carriers through the streets, firing recoilless rifles, and gangs run by local warlords with rocket-propelled grenade launchers and AK-47s. And there were huge crowds of refugees carrying all their worldly belongings in shopping carts and in pillowcases, women with baskets on their heads. And there were prostitutes and maimed beggars and naked children playing in polluted pools of filthy water and old men with begging bowls. And the gangs of the different warlords would demand tribute. And we gave them all of our belongings. And the squalor was breathtaking, exquisite, pandemic, universal, overwhelming. And we were exhilarated by the pain and suffering that we saw. Every time we were robbed, we felt a sense of, yes, this is what it's about. This is life. This is the real thing. This is not like the life we led back in the United States, that bourgeois, boring, predictable, coddled, pampered existence. Even when members of our party were summarily executed or shot down by drunken soldiers, we felt that our purpose was achieved. These were the richest experiences. We knew that when these things happened, that we would never forget them. This would be the high point of our lives. And when one of our comrades was taken blindfolded, hung upside down from a tree, beaten with rubber truncheons, shot and then set aflame, we thought, it doesn't get any better than this. We felt as if we were on a euphoric drug, our hearts full, our souls as though for the first time, alive. But by the time we made it to the base of K2, most of us were so ill and so exhausted that we could hardly stand up. So we never made the attempt to climb it. And I found it very interesting and quite compelling that the entire enterprise had involved exclusively getting to the mountain, but not actually climbing it. And from this, we inferred that the lesson to be learned might be that the actual doing of something is not as important as preparing to do it. So the act itself is really unnecessary. It really has no meaning. It's an afterthought. What really matters is approaching the challenge. To then actually engage the experience is really a waste of your time, when you could be spending that time facing new risks. In other words, once we had finally arrived at the mountain, climbing it became irrelevant, because we had already, in a sense, climbed it. Through the difficulty and obstacles and suffering we'd experienced, we had already become it. We knew it. We'd experienced it. And so we considered the expedition a success, and we meet every year on that date and throw a big party at which we show slides and tell stories about everything we did leading up to the climb that we never made. And in retrospect, I think we all agree that it was one of the most gratifying and fulfilling experiences of our lives, because we considered the event an ascent, albeit a horizontal ascent. Horizontal or vertical, it didn't really matter. That seemed a minor distinction. And we're still angry that the Academy did not accept our claim that we actually reached the top of K2, because we felt that we had ascended it without actually ascending it. We had ascended it in the sense that we had risen above the concept of ascension.
That was Joe Frank, an excerpt from his hour Mountain Rain, mixed by Bob Carlson. The music is by MC 900 Foot Jesus. JoeFrank.com is the home of all his Franken stories. Quiet American field recordings and musical manipulations are at QuietAmerican.org. I'm Barrett Golding, and there's links to everything you heard this hour at HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.